Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yoes, your host. Thank you for joining us for our first of 2 hours on this Friday. Make sure to follow us on Twitter at First Edition 88.9, and don't forget to like and follow us on Facebook at First Edition on WEAA 88.9 FM. Go to WEAA.org on our homepage for the latest podcast of First Edition, or subscribe to our iTunes podcast, First Edition. Also, hit me up on my personal Twitter account. The tag is at Sean Yoes. That is my name, S-E-A-N-Y-O-E-S. Or go to my Facebook page. If you have information, insight, or breaking news you want to share with me, I'll share it with the people unless you don't want me to. And, of course, I won't do that. Coming up in the second hour of the show, it is the world-famous happy hour. And I'm telling you, I've been looking forward to this one for a long time, actually more than a year. The Elders, Paradox Family, Deep Sugar Family, The Elders, Danny and Katie will sit down for a quick chat. Then they're going to play live at 6. The Rulers of the Chamber at the Docks, The Elders playing live on the world-famous happy hour. Techno House lovers are going to literally lose their minds. It's going to be great. All right, it's coming up in the second hour of the show on the World Famous. A little bit later, in the first hour, the Mod Squad will be here. That is Stephen Janis and Taya Graham of the Real News Network reporting on law enforcement and politics, including more reporting on the egregious murder of Charmaine Wilson a few days ago. This story just keeps getting worse and worse. Well, I don't know if it can get worse for her family, but so we'll get into that in a little while. But first, the top news stories. Some of the top news stories directly from the pages of the Afro newspaper. In the studio with me is Kamal. Hi, he's the managing editor of the Afro. Kamal, welcome to the show.
Hi, Sean. How are you?
I'm doing good. And I also want to welcome a former senior producer of First Edition and current and always mentor, founder of Son of a Dream, wrote a very poignant Father's Day op-ed on forgiveness in this week's edition of the Afro. My friend Bobby Marvin Holmes is here as well. Bobby, good to see you, man.
Good to see you as well, big brother. How you feel?
I feel good. I feel good, you know. So let's start off with this breaking news. The officer, the police officer who gunned down Philando Castillo in Minnesota in 2016, Geronimo Yanez of the St. Anthony Police Department, according to the New York Times, acquitted of all charges. He was facing, I believe, second-degree manslaughter charges. I think that was the top charge against him, and there were additional charges as well. Acquitted of all charges in the death of Philando Castillo. If you remember, his girlfriend, Castillo's girlfriend, remarkably live-streamed the aftermath of Castillo's shooting in 2016. She had the tenacity, the courage, and the calm to continue filming while her boyfriend was literally dying next to her in the car when he was given an order to he was going to show that he had a permit to carry a gun, and Geronimo Yanez shot him fatally as a result. Again, Geronimo Yanez, the officer who fatally shot Philando Castillo, acquitted of all charges, according to the New York Times. So that breaking news just in. Let's go to the pages of the Afro newspaper. Top story, the top photo here, the U.S. Poet Laureate, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet Tracy K. Smith, new Poet Laureate for the United States.
Yes, she was named by Carla Hayden, former CEO of the Enoch Pratt Library System here in Baltimore, who went on to become the U.S. librarian, essentially. And yes, so we put her on the front, a big smiling picture. She is a poet, very respected, obviously a Pulitzer Prize winner. And we felt that this was, you know, not only did it have a Baltimore connection, but it's also great to see a poet sort of getting this recognition.
Of course. And like I was saying to you, Kamau, this is, in my memory, one of the younger poet laureates of the United States, a woman of color. So I'm personally kind of proud to see that happen. So kudos to her.
Kudos to her.
We have two stories that deal with the issue of hate crimes by Chantella Sherman for the Afro this week.
Yes, one our top story is that Chantella's reporting on how a new era of hate crimes appears to be on the rise in the U.S., and some experts are attributing it to some of the harsh rhetoric that U.S. President Donald Trump invoked during not only the campaign but into his presidency.
Well, I mean, I saw somebody the other day, Kamau and Bobby, right, I think it was an op-ed, actually, and they said specifically in the headline, the campaign is over, Mr. Trump. I mean, he's still in campaign mode, quite frankly.
Yes.
It's breathtaking that a sitting United States president, quote-unquote, would just, I mean, what else can you say? It seems surreal. It seems surreal the entire time, actually.
Yes. Well, it's also interesting, you know, in the wake of the U.S. representative who was shot the other day while preparing for the baseball game, you saw surrogates of Donald Trump, such as Newt Gingrich, going out there and blaming the alleged shooter who was a Bernie Sanders supporter and saying, like, ah, see, this is the harsh rhetoric of the left. And it's like, and it's funny because Newt Gingrich, when Bill Clinton was president, was using some of the harshest rhetoric that I can ever recall. He was the sort of person who would go around implying that the Clintons murdered Vince Foster.
And was really the lead agitator in the impeachment of Bill Clinton.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Well, you know, and yeah, yes. Yeah. He played a role.
Yeah. And connected to another hate crime story is the question, as we continue our reporting, on the murder of Richard Collins.
Yes, Bowie State University student who was shot at who was killed at the College Park campus of University of Maryland a few weeks ago. And while the FBI is continuing to sort of investigate and trying to determine whether or not it should be classified as a hate crime, we go through some of the sort of criteria of, like, what actually makes a hate crime. It's not just, generally speaking, someone using a racial slur and then killing someone. There's a whole process for them to declare something a hate crime.
Right. Let's go to the Baltimore section.
Yes.
My favorite section.
Yes. Well, now, speaking of Baltimore section, now that it's your first week sort of as Baltimore editor, what do you have to say? We're going to do your personal evaluation on the air. I figure the audience will enjoy that.
It was fun. It was a bit harrowing at times, but I think the final product, I'm happy with it. It looks good. It sounds good.
Yes. So it looks good. I agree.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And part of the reason why it sounds and looks good is Bobby Marvin Holmes' piece, poignant op-ed in the newspaper. Bobby, you know, I know that you've done amazing work with young men, black boys, for years as a mentor and someone who's been an advocate for children. So I thought it was really a brilliant thing to have you write an op-ed on Father's Day. Talk about some of the emotions that, because I mean, Kamal and I both agree that really nicely done. But very, very poignant and not syrupy at all. A real story about fatherhood and about forgiveness, which is so, so important. The message is so important.
Yes, it was, you know, this piece I've actually been writing for years. It was so intimate and personal, I was very reluctant to release it. I finally decided to do so, working on this book that I am releasing in October. But my biological father and my mom split up when I was a little kid. I would say I was probably around 3-4 years old when they had their split. I didn't see him again till I was about 11-12 years old. And it was by chance that my mother and I, we ran into his sister, my aunt, while we were out shopping. Mm. And, you know, that's when the reunited began. And my aunt took me to see him. I can't forget the night. It was sometime in the summer. It was dark out in East Baltimore. We went into the house. It was dark in the house, and he was like, I guess you could say, in the living room area. And when he saw me, he began to try to guess who I was.
But even you wrote specifically about the fact that he kind of emerged from the shadows, which to me was symbolic of the fact that he was not present in your life at all. He almost was like a phantasm coming out of the shadows. In my mind, that's what it triggered.
You know, because it was like we was walking through the corridor, you know, in the hallways, and then I turned to my right, and you know, there he was, you know. Kind of peering out from the dark right there, standing in the middle of the floor. And my aunt was like, you know, hey, Rob, you know what this? That's my biological father's name. Hey, Rob, you know what this is? And she said, and he's like, no. And he began guessing different people in the family who this is. And my aunt, you know, she got agitated and annoyed. And she said, that's Teddy. Teddy's my family nickname. Mm-hmm. And, you know, silence broke the room. You know, silence broke out in the room. And I just went on in the house and went to speak to my grandfather upstairs, who was ill. I came downstairs. My father was slouching in the chair with his head down crying. And my aunt said, ask him, what's wrong with you? And all he can say was, it's not my fault. It's not my fault. Mm-hmm. And like I said, I haven't seen him since I was about 3 or 4 years old, and I was 12 then. So that began the process of us reuniting, me coming around my aunt. He started to come around a little bit more, but for the first time, you know, it wasn't boundaries. My father did start to go deeper into the streets after my parents split apart and went, you know, towards that lifestyle.
Right.
So my mother tried to keep me away from him, to keep me safe.
Right.
She would tell me, she shared one story with me where she had to come get me out of a house that he was in. He was in there, I guess, preparing for a sale, preparing drugs and so forth. And she had to come get me out of the house when I was a little boy.
Right.
So we began to reunite. And during this period, he would call me here and there. I would see him here and there. But yet and still, he would not put a solid effort into being a part of my life and to coming around more and coming to get me more.
Right.
And then from that, anger started to develop.
Right.
I started to refer to him as a deadbeat dad.
Right.
The anger began to fester.
Right.
I remember a time I was over at my aunt's house and she was talking to him and she's like, hey, you know, your father on the phone, your dad on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
And I responded back, oh, I don't want to talk to that deadbeat. It's my first time ever saying that out loud.
But how did you begin to move to the process of forgiveness? Because the whole abandonment is a very right. prevalent thing, a pervasive thing in our community, unfortunately. But how did you move towards the process of forgiveness with your dad? Because I know it's taken some time.
It still is.
Right.
You know, we spoke briefly last night. It was a journey, Sean. It wasn't until, you know, I became an adult that him and I decided to again connect and share some time with each other and spend time with each other, laughing, playing, you know, watching football games and just cutting it up, father and son. But it wasn't until I would say I was like 31, 32 that him and I actually sat down and had a conversation about what happened. We actually addressed the elephant
in the
room.
You were sitting in your car, right?
Yes. I had a project due. I'm in grad school and I had a paper that was due. And I reached out to him for help.
Mm-hmm.
And when I reached out to him, you know, to help me write the paper, to try to tell my story, he agreed. And I came over his house and we sat outside of my car and we just talked. You know, the quarter was on and he just spilt the beans, so to speak, about what happened over the years. And I said to his face for the very first time, all my life, I tried not to be like you.
Right.
Every turn. Every decision, I try not to be like. I made a conscious decision when I was a little boy not to be like you.
Right.
And that's tough, I'm sure, for any father to hear.
Of course.
But he took it. And to me, that was the best thing he could do, was just listen
and
to me.
Right.
Not argue, not deny, not blame, but just sit there and listen to me. And I know that was hard for him to do. But he did it. And the process of us, the process of me forgiving was really dealing with my anger towards him.
Of course, of course.
Learn to check that anger. You know, like so many boys out here without fathers, so many children, period, without fathers, just dealing with that pain, that anger. And for me, it was I had a lot of anger on my chest that I had to really deal with in order to get to the path of forgiveness.
It took a lot for you to make this a public process writing about it. And you are going to write about it in your upcoming book. What's it called again?
Yes. 100 Real Talk for Our Boys. It's been released in October of this year. As you said earlier on, I work with boys here in Baltimore City. So this is a piece that I'm writing, a collection of personal essays and poems to engage boys around hard-hitting issues such as fatherlessness, forgiveness, bullying, as well as gun violence in our city.
Bobby Marvin Holmes, former producer of First, senior producer of First Edition, and contributed op-ed piece for the Afro. Son of a Dream is your organization. Thank you, Bobby.
Thank you, Sean. Thank you, Kamal. Appreciate it.
Good to see you, man.
All right. As we continue on the pages of the Afro, how did my section of how did the Baltimore section wind up missing in my newspaper? There's something strange.
You need to get your weight up.
I got plenty of weight, bro.
Maybe you need new people.
I need new people.
Would you like to borrow my section?
Well, no, I actually remember everything.
I was say we were at the office until midnight. Just to pull the curtain back a little for the audience.
I closed my eyes and I remember everything.
Yes. The paper is a gift, but it is a process to get it to you.
It is a process. Go get it.
Buy it. Don't borrow someone else's.
No, buy the Afro.
Don't be a skin flint.
Yeah, buy the Afro. An obituary about Rosetta Stith, Dr. Rosetta Stith. She died, I believe, in May of dementia, but the news just kind of came out recently, and there's a memorial service for her June 16th, which is today. There's a candlelight vigil today, and I think there's a memorial service at Vaughn Green's out at Liberty.
Yes, tomorrow.
But Dr. Stith, for those of you who don't know who she was, she was the principal of the Paquin Middle High School for Expectant Mothers. Up until the 1960s, young girls who got pregnant or teenagers that got pregnant in public schools had to leave school point blank. They could not go to school. So the Paquin School, when it opened in the 60s, filled a tremendous void, obviously. And Dr. Stith, becoming the principal in 1980, she's the assistant principal in 1974, became the principal in 1980, became a very vigorous advocate for the education of teen mothers, and then also teenage pregnancy prevention. She took that role to the international stage, becoming an advocate in many different countries, was in the New York Times, various news and current affairs shows. So really someone who was a champion for young women who were teenage mothers, just she affected the lives of literally hundreds. We got an obit of Dr. Stith in the Baltimore section, as well as the Father's Day tribute that Bobby Marvin Holmes produced.
So as well as your column,
my column as well. what did I talk about?
You talked about how in August there are two young women who are calling for a ceasefire,
right?
As the number of homicides reach record-breaking numbers here in Baltimore, these two women, among many other people who are all trying to find a solution, are proposing that the days of August
4th through the 6th,
there be no homicides whatsoever.
Right, no killing for 72 hours.
Yes, this is obviously a incredibly large and difficult task, but we wish them all the best.
Absolutely.
I mean, the amount of violence that goes on in the city, and particularly with the story that we were just talking about.
Charmaine Wilson.
Yeah, Charmaine Wilson being killed for reporting on drug activity in her neighborhood.
Erica Bridgeford and LNG are spearheading. They are the organizers of the Baltimore ceasefire, again, August 4th to the 6th. 72 hours, no murder. That is what we are calling for. We're going to continue to talk about the Baltimore ceasefire movement every Thursday on First Edition from the 5 to 6 o'clock hour until August 4th. There are cookouts being arranged, parties being arranged, house music, whatever we can do to keep people calm and cool and safe for those 72 hours. We're going to put in work. Much respect to Erica Bridgeford and LNG and everybody connected to the Baltimore ceasefire movement, and it is a movement. And we're going to have some reporting on that also in this week's paper, and I believe something on the weekend, hopefully, at afro.com as well. What else is in the Baltimore section?
Well, one of our reporters, J.K. Schmidt, went out on patrol with Acting Captain Monique Brown in the 13-mile-wide Southern District, and sort of brought us a report back on, you know, what's it like when you're out at night as a police officer, sort of making the rounds, you know, sort of keeping things calm, trying to prevent things from popping off, as the kids like to say, and sort of doing, you know, your day-to-day job. You know, so we sort of explore that, especially I think it's especially relevant what with the recent Baltimore City budget coming in and upping the police budget when exactly. At first it looked like there would be an actual cut to it.
But it actually added $17 million, bringing it up to, I believe, $497 million, almost a half a billion dollars for law enforcement in Baltimore. We also have a brief story about Kurt Schmoak being installed as the chair of trustees for BCCC, the Baltimore City Community College, wearing the hat of chair of trustees for BCCC, as well as president of the University of Baltimore, causing some concern in the minds of people.
Yes, I mean, BCCC is not part of the university system, while the University of Baltimore is. BCCC is a majority black school, while the University of Baltimore is a majority white school. And Kurt Schmoak will be essentially in the leadership positions for both of those schools at the same time. So this is something that we'll be keeping an eye on, and you can expect more reporting from in the pages of the Afro.
Absolutely. But for now, we're going to have to call it quits. You'll be back next week?
Yes, I will.
All right. And the Afro will be around as well.
You certainly will.
You certainly will.
Thank you very much, Sean.
Thank you, Kamal. I appreciate it. All right. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, the Mod Squad will be here. That is Stephen Janice and Taya Graham of the Real News Network. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition. Sean Yoes, your host, making the transition from the news, from the pages of the Afro newspaper, to the work of the Mod Squad there in the studio. It is Taya Graham and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network. Friends, welcome back. Good to see you.
Thank you, Sean. Very glad to be here.
Glad to have you. Thank you for sitting in for me on Wednesday.
Oh, no problem.
Of course, you can tag us in anytime, Sean.
Yeah, all right. No. I appreciate that.
No problem.
So we've got a couple of things. Let's first talk about the murder of Charmaine Wilson.
Yes.
Everybody who was around, and especially reporters, remember the Dawsons.
Mm-hmm.
The first I saw that Charmaine Wilson was one of the people murdered in that six, when those six people, I believe it was the night mm-hmm. the six people got killed.
Yes.
And then there was another murder, and I saw, and I only saw brief details. When I started reading about the details, the immediate thought came to me. It was like, this is the Dawson family all over again.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
This is a woman whose family, members of her family, I believe her children, had been bullied on a consistent basis, and she had the courage to reach out to law enforcement and try to get help for them.
Yes.
And in return, she was killed.
And she was killed while police were investigating her complaint, is what I read. And
right, according to T.J. Smith, I think that the officers were supposed to be at the corner store looking over video evidence.
Video footage, surveillance footage, and she was killed during that period of time that the police were actually on the scene, which is, I guess, points to a certain extent
the brazenness,
the desperation, the anger in the city. And the fact that, you know, it does show another thing, that you could put police on every corner, and if the community is sick, it's not going to matter. I mean, really, I mean, what can you expect? She just called the police are around the corner, and someone shoots her. That shows either, one, that people don't care about whether there's a cop there or not. Number two, it simply shows that putting cops on every corner probably isn't going to solve the problem in the long run.
You know what? It also reminds me, unfortunately, of another tragic murder of Kendall Fenwick in Park Heights, the father of three children.
He was building
a fence to try to make his home safe from drug dealers, because trying to sell basically in his front yard.
Right.
And he simply asked the young men, please don't sell the drugs in front of my three kids on my front yard. And he was killed for doing so.
And then prosecutors said recently in court that it might have even just been pure mistaken identity. Like, it wasn't even about the fence, but just that they just shot the wrong guy. Which is, you know, I mean, we have met plenty of cases of people, just incidental victims. The 4-year-old, I can't remember her name, who was shot and killed, Mackenzie Elliott,
yes.
4 years old. I mean, I'm pretty certain that they weren't targeting her, but they just shot her anyway.
I remember even years prior, Tiffany Smith, I believe, the little girl on...
I know where you're talking
over
about.
Over in West Baltimore.
Yeah, this city is littered with this, which, you know, speaks to a grave existential crisis in this city about, you know, about who we are and how we think. Because it's to shoot somebody, I mean, obviously people aren't afraid of going to jail.
Right.
Now, of course, there's a lot of questions about that, whether or not we're catching that many people that do it, and that's a whole other issue. But nevertheless, you know, when you look at these cases, I mean, what would happen? What if we put the National Guard in every corner? Would it make a difference?
But the question, I think, one of the questions that is in people's minds is, if Charmaine Wilson indeed had on more than one basis reported to police or asked police for protection because her children were being bullied— I mean, we know what happened to the Dawson family and the mother and father, the mother in particular, who continually reported to police.
Right.
What is the system of protection for witnesses?
Oh, well.
I mean, we know police on a regular, all the time, ask for people to come forward despite the ubiquitous, pervasive stop snitching atmosphere in Baltimore, despite the fact that cops won't snitch on each other.
Right.
So what measure of protection can we give people who do have the strength and the courage to come forward?
The last time I checked, I mean, and it's been a long time since, several years ago, the amount of money they spent was about $500,000 for witness protection in Baltimore City to the state's attorney's office, which isn't a lot, right?
And Stephen, wasn't the type of protection that you were told about was really just being put in a hotel room just a few miles outside of town?
Yeah, I mean, it's not like they relocate people with the new identities, and most of the time they don't give them anything at all. So really, it's not irrational for people who want to survive to not talk. I mean, what you're talking about an act, you know, I remember writing about a woman who was at a trial of a gang member, an alleged gang member, and she was the only witness, and, you know, she testified, and I was like, you know, people talk about cops being brave, but to go into that courtroom, and he had all his people there. I'm not going to say the case or anything, but he had all his people there watching. There's no one on the side of the victim, just all these guys, young men, watching her. And I was like, man, that is, I wrote it as the bravest woman in Baltimore, because you have to be the bravest person. You're going to have nothing when you get out. I mean, you know that they're not going to sit there and follow up and put you in Arizona or something. You're going back to your neighborhood by yourself, unarmed. For politicians to exhort people to, I think you raise a great point, to say people need to stop snitching. Well, you're asking them to risk their lives. Right. Why are they going to do that? Why should they do that? You know.
And in some cases, don't people risk like actually having a body attachment put on them?
Yeah,
and
I mean, that
being
was a
placed
big,
in jail.
If you, for example, initially become a witness and then later on you are you decide you don't want to testify, a lot of times, at least before, I don't know if this is true during the current administration, but before, previous administrations under Bernstein, they would get body attachments, dozens, hundreds of them a year, where you would actually be in jail waiting to testify, because if you wouldn't testify, the prosecutor would put
Isn't
you
that
in jail.
Incredible? Isn't that an incredible reward for being brave
for
enough
stepping
to,
forward.
For stepping forward to be given a body attachment placed in jail?
You up.
But, you know, I mean, you know, it's something we've, but this is not new, but this is something we've dealt with. And Sean, as you point out, there's a cycle of this kind of retaliation.
Right.
And it shows that how difficult it is once violence is situated in a community, how difficult it is to stop it, to get rid of it, because it continues to feed upon itself.
Indeed. Let me take a couple of phone calls before we go forward. Let's go to Thomas in Churchville. Thomas, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Sean, congratulations on your new appointment, man. You're well deserved.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate you.
And listen, Mod Squad, I got a homework assignment. Homework assignment.
Oh, okay.
Okay, I'll take notes.
This will be a good weekend to do it.
Okay.
Under Kevin Davis's tenure, 938 murders under his tenure since he took over as commissioner. Why does he still have his job?
I mean, based upon past situations, like I remember they fired Leonard Hamm after.
Thomas, thank you.
I remember specifically there was a really bad January when Sheila Dixon had just taken over for Martin O'Malley. It was like 45 murders, and Hamm got the boot. That would be former Commissioner Leonard Hamm. I believe it was timed with a very bad weekend, and you know, I don't think bats had anything to do with it. But certainly, that's usually been the case that a police commissioner does get a bit. I mean, let's just be honest for a second. That police department is a mess based upon what we have reported and based upon what we have read from the Department of Justice. What are you going to do? I mean, you're going to bring in another commissioner? I had a person that we all know say, I've worked for 12 commissioners in 14 years. I'm not working for another one.
Working for another.
I'm not going to mention his name. Right. He could be listening.
I know who you are.
You know who I'm talking to. Sean knows that. We all know who we're talking about. And you, how much instability? I mean, I do think this is a good time, though, to have the discussion of the limitations of policing. Of course, when people are shooting each other in the streets, who else can you turn to? I mean, can something like Safe Streets really do it? Because that's something that we're going to be looking at next week.
Yeah, we are going
but,
to be looking
at
that.
I mean, is that the way to
but
is it putting out people without guns to talk to people with guns? I don't know.
But it's certainly not the Gun Trace Task Force that we're supposed to be turning to.
Right, and that's, you know, they're still talking about guns. Davis actually talked in the article in The Sun, which you make a great point. You can talk about that if you want.
I mean, well, I was just mentioning the Gun Trace Task Force, which has been known for planting guns on young men. For example, we spoke with Ivan Potts, who was a young man who was quite rightfully freed and acquitted because he had a gun planted on him by, I think it was two or three of the Baltimore 7 officers who were doing their own version of training day where they were taxing people. They've been federally indicted for this. They were taking money from citizens with legitimate businesses and illegitimate businesses as well as planting guns on people. So when they're members of the Gun Trace Task Force that are not collecting guns, they're not stopping violence, perhaps they're actually encouraging.
And, you know, we're at a really interesting juncture because this is the first time, as we noted in this past council hearing recently, where people have started to say, whoa, wait a second. And Sean, you brought this up about paying, not using policing to solve these problems. So if you fire the commissioner, you're basically saying, yeah, well, really, what we really mean is it is really about policing. All this is just window dressing that we're going to invest more in rec centers and make sure the kids are working. But, you know, there was another crime recently, a guy, one of the assistant health director who runs Safe Streets, and he was, I saw that the police released a video. And a 16-year-old kid, I mean, the guy was walking, turning on Commerce Street into Baltimore Street, which anyone who works downtown knows it's like right in the heart of downtown. And it's two blocks from the police.
And a block.
Two blocks. It's right on the block, and it's two blocks from the police headquarters.
Right.
And in broad daylight, they jumped him
from
behind. They banked him. Well, I don't know if they banked him. Bank means you have to hold the guy.
They ganked him.
Okay. So, but it's just, you know, you kind of reached a point where you don't really know what to say because it's so brutal and so, I mean, there's...
You can understand the fear.
We had a conversation on Thursday, yesterday, with three people leading up to this Baltimore ceasefire for August 4th through the 6th. We're going to have conversations every Thursday up until that date to talk about solutions to violence and bringing on people who are participating directly in the movement to keep Baltimoreans safe for 72 hours during those that three-day period. But one of the cats said to me, and he was from out of town, he said with wonder, like, how is the police department headquarters right, like, two blocks or a block away, not even a block, I mean, basically adjacent to the Baltimore block, the strip.
Oh,
yes, that's a very interesting.
And City Hall's right around the corner from
there.
Well, what that illustrates is a really schizophrenic relationship between vice in our city and
exactly.
the people who are running this city.
But we're from here, so it's something you kind of grow up with.
And you don't think to really question.
Right. And then, but when an outsider says, what is this?
Well, I did an article for Next property. American City on the block, and it is at that point, that was like 10 years ago, it was one of the only remaining red light districts that had not been altered since red light districts sort of came about. Most other cities like Boston and whatever had gotten rid of them.
Especially because this area would be prime real estate in any other
technically,
city.
Technically, right.
It is prime real estate. So I would say that this is part of our tourism, how we build things for people to appreciate that don't live in Baltimore. The people who come and enjoy the block are the same people who come to Camden Yards and the same people who come to the Inner Harbor and the same people stay in the hotels and go to the conferences.
It's part of our tourism. That's what they say, that without the tourism, without the games, there would be no block.
That's
block
right.
I mean, it couldn't be sustained by the residents, it's by the people.
And tourism is part of our
but
money
most,
here in Baltimore.
Most cities,
that's
as Sean points out, move those things to like places like Pulaski Highway, which is where there is stuff like that, and not in the center core, right between.
Literally.
You literally can't walk.
You can walk from the block. The block is here, and I mean, we're on radio, but the block is here, it's right here.
It always struck me as funny when you're covering voting, and you come out of the Board of Elections in Baltimore, and you walk out the door, and you see, like, you know, you see boobs flashing, you know, neon lights.
Yeah,
because the block is right by the Board of Elections. It's right there, it's just weird.
It is weird. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to First Edition here on WEAA 88.9. I'm Sean Yose, your host. I'm in the studio with the Mod Squad. That is Taya Graham and Stephen Janice of the Real News Network.
Let me just sort of, is that like just keeping it real? Like having the block?
Well, what I was going to say is keeping
like
it honest.
Saying this is what we are?
I think it's actually just being honest about what Baltimore's priorities are. That we put our money.
That we'll do anything to bring people in
that
here.
That we'll do anything to bring
we'll
people in.
We'll give you tax breaks.
We will offer up our women. We will offer tax breaks. We will
whatever
give you
it takes.
Whatever it takes.
We'll put any restaurant on the Inner Harbor.
Yes.
Sorry, Austin.
No, you're all right. Let's take a couple of more calls, though. Rose has been holding on for a while. Rose in Baltimore, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
I'm fine.
Okay.
How do I get in touch with the Mod Squad? Are you guys on Facebook?
Absolutely. You can contact me, Taya M. Graham, on Facebook or Twitter. I have my own page. It's called Taya's Baltimore. And then, of course, you can contact Stephen Janice. It's Stephen with a P-H, Janice, J-A-N-I-S.
And that's the Real News Network?
Yeah, we're on the Real News Network.
And you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
Yeah.
Okay, here's my comment. I don't know about you guys, but when the uprising in Baltimore happened, a lot of people I talked to, particularly in my neighborhood, when they brought the National Guard in and they were on every corner, remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I slept well. I felt good. I was not afraid. You know, I was not afraid. I saw people walking their kids. You know, I saw people taking chairs and tables away from their doors. And
do you really want the National Guard in the era of Trump sitting in your neighborhood? Hello?
I don't know. We just lost.
You know, but
we
that's
just lost Rose.
Okay, let me tell you one mind-blowing fact before you say anything.
Okay.
I talked to one of those guys who was outside City Hall, and I said, you know, what kind of gun? And he said, let me tell you something. He said, there are no bullets in these guns. I said, really? He said, yeah, we don't put any bullets in them. Anyway, shouldn't have said that because now...
Uh-oh. Now the secret's out.
Yeah, it's okay. Let's go to Donna next. Donna, you're on with the Mod Squad. How you doing?
Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you now. Go, Donna.
Yes,
how you doing?
Yeah.
All right.
Pretty good. Well, the problem with the young lady was killed with the 8 children, they live in very, the communities are disenfranchised and poor. Mm-hmm. And so our poor people live in communities where there's a, you know, there may be a small pocket of mentally ill people who would commit these type of, you know, sociopathic type behavior. And the only way we can probably cut down on that is to find out where, you know, get them when they're younger, like children. Because the ones who've done these killings, the one who killed her, when they find out, I guarantee, you know, they had a long rap sheet from the time they were probably even in middle school, maybe have behavior issues even in elementary. And also, has any reporter ever gone and talked to the guys who have committed, like the Dawsons, have anybody ever tried to talk to him, interview
yes.
him?
Yes, I have.
Yeah.
I actually...
And how about interviewing some of the other ones? Because we need to find out where these young men come from.
I can tell you something about the Dawson guy. Because I
Donna, thank you.
During an investigation of lead poisoning, I actually wrote to the young man in prison who had thrown the actual Molotov cocktail, because it had been said that he was actually had been severely lead poisoned as a child. And actually the prosecutors mentioned the fact that he was mentally disabled. And part of the story was that he had actually been prompted to do this by people who weren't mentally disabled, that he was sort of not equipped to make a full decision. And I corresponded with him multiple times. And, you know, he obviously was not completely in control of his faculties. It's really a tragedy because everyone knows that lead poisoning creates impulsivity, the inability to make executive function kind of decisions. So it's kind of one of those things where you start to see all the roots of the violence in his story, because he was not mentally equipped, but he also, you know, grew up in Baltimore. We do try to talk to people, and we do try to, and it's that's why I wrote a book called Why Do We Kill? The Pathology of Murder, not to pitch my book. But the point was that it's kind of like a social disease that kind of not just is rooted in things like lead poisoning and other types of elements, but also just the continued sort of mosaic of all this violence kind of infects all of us. You know, we all become different because it changes all of us in some ways. None of us are immune to the effects of it. And then people have to live with it under the constant threat of death. Are altered, and there's studies that show that, right? That people who live in high stress environments have changes in their psychology and changes in their thinking patterns. You know, it takes away your long term thinking. You become very short term focused, and you become less capable of dealing with complex issues. So, yeah, we do. I do personally, but I agree that is a very good point. If we don't listen to the people who commit these horrible acts, we're never going to learn and understand how to fix it.
Right, indeed. Let's shift gears to, I believe you have a conversation with City Council President Bernard Jack Young recently. What were we talking to? Because you were talking about crime, correct?
Right. We were talking about crime and violence in Baltimore City, and I think actually some of the things that City Council President had to say were quite prescient in talking about. He in particular talked about trying to stop snitching culture in Baltimore, meaning that people should feel comfortable coming forward to talk about crimes committed in their neighborhood, but at the same time address the issue that he can understand why people are frightened, that they aren't protected. And he was saying that we need to find some creative ways to be able to protect our citizens when they're brave enough to come forward and talk about crime in the community.
All right. Let's listen to that clip. We'll talk on the other side. Let's go.
Drugs and beefs. Beef? You disrespect me, or you took my you robbed my guy, you know, from his drugs, and a lot of it stems from, you know, you messing with my lady, you know. So it's a whole host of factors that's driving the murder rate. But if you look at the murder rate and what's happening, it's targeted. It's like premeditated. Like, I'm going to go out and kill Steve tonight, because he done set up shop in my area where I control, you know? So I think that's what's fueling all these killings. But I don't think we can police our way out of it. We need the whole community to come up and say, hey, enough is enough, you know?
So that's Bernard Jack Young, city council president, exacerbated as a lot of people are about
Absolutely.
What's happening over the last
Well, and one thing, I would just, as someone who's covered Jack for a long time, he's always kind of espoused what we talk about now, which is, you know, he wants to end the war on drugs completely.
Absolutely.
He wants to decriminalize everything because he's talking there about how he feels about, you know, turf wars.
Sure. And I think he was addressing some of the things that your caller Donna was asking about, is of why are people engaging in these activities and what are the things that we need to do to try to break this cycle of violence in our community. And I think in the next clip, he talks about something interesting, which is that we know that there's drug activity, drug use in some of the white communities in Baltimore, but we don't see the same levels of violence.
We don't. Let's listen to that clip and we'll talk on the other side.
To you.
Okay, we're getting it ready.
Well, sure. I mean, and he talks about how we don't see those levels of violence in the white community as well. And then he also talks about, I think he talks about that you can, mm-hmm. he says something that I think is a little bit controversial, which is that the police department isn't responsible for the murders in our community. Mm. And
well, they're not.
Right. And when he says that, he is kind of directing it back into our hands. It's our community. We need to take charge. Now, I think, Stephen, do you think he's mm-hmm. willing to give our community the tools that it needs to make these
Well,
changes?
I mean, like I said before, I mean, if anyone was on the front end of this argument about taking money out of policing and putting it into community, it would have been Jack Young.
Right.
I mean, he like I said, he wanted to end the drug war. He did push through the youth fund, 3% youth fund that
right.
you know is going to be allocating money to youth programs.
And he has one. And he said he did want to take money from the police budget that he didn't have the support in the city council previously.
So he did want to take that money. Go ahead.
We got the clip.
Okay.
Let's hear it and we'll talk on the other side.
Well, socially, because people don't want to come here because they think we're a deadly city. But I always ask the question, wasn't there murders, you know, drug-related murders in Guilford, Roland Park, Canton, and all these affluent areas? They just mostly in African-American communities. Blacks killing blacks. And I have a problem with that, you know. But I cannot hold the police department accountable for targeted murders. We as a community have to step up to the plate. And when we see things and know things, we have to report it. Then people say, well, if I report it, there's no protection for me or my family. You know,
No, we heard that. If we report it, what's going to happen? And,
right.
and with the stark, the horrible example of yeah. Charmaine Wilson.
And it's a terrible story to illustrate what will happen. And like I said, I don't know how underneath Commissioner Davis' tenure, how they're handling police protection for people who want to come forward. But I know previously it was a hotel room just a few miles out of town. It really wasn't anything at all.
It would be really helpful if we could shift. I mean, I know that there are lines of delineation, of course, between the state's attorney's office and law and the police department. But how can you not find it more than plausible and more than right to shift millions of dollars
yes.
into a system,
yes.
into a context that will help protect people if
Absolutely.
You are imploring them to come forward?
Mm-hmm.
You have to do more than give them a hotel room just outside of town.
Exactly.
This isn't like, I mean, I was about to say it's not like Dodge City, but then again it is.
Mm-hmm.
It just seems unbelievable that we haven't just crafted a system that does more and is more thorough in protecting
yeah.
people who come forward.
Yeah, I mean, you know, and also I think, just to add on to that, I don't think you can blame the police department, but I do think so long as the police department is the most dominant institution and the best funded,
Absolutely.
And the court, Mitchell Courthouse dominates the downtown, and the prison system to the left of it is the largest, you know, sort of complex, bigger than any sort of manufacturing complex, we will, I think, continue to suffer from violence because I think in some way the symbolism of it and the psyche that it engenders will always kind of consume us in a way. I don't know how else to describe it, but I've never been in a community where policing and everything is a constant. And it's sometimes hard for me to say what comes first, our obsession with policing or violence. I don't know. I mean, you can't blame police.
Right.
It is us. But at the same time, that emphasis, I think, limits us.
I think we have one more clip. Are we ready?
We're ready.
All right, let's go. Let's run that.
With a couple of my friends offline, some judges, and say, why can't we have people to testify like they do in federal court without anybody knowing who they are? They say because the defendant have a right to know who their accusers are. I think that's the worst thing that you could ever do. I think we need to protect people because we can't protect them. We can't protect their family. And I think that we should find, our federal government should find a way to be creative to let these folks who want to testify, who have seen murders, do it anonymously. That's the only way.
Well, it seems like perfectly cogent argument to make, right?
Yeah. And I thought it was an absolutely perfect point in relation to what poor Miss Charmaine Wilson and her family is going through right now. We do need to find some sort of creative way to protect people if they are brave enough and bold enough to come forward and be witnesses about the violence and the crime that's going on in our community. And when we're talking about putting money towards policing or putting money towards youth programs, you mentioned Miss Erica Bridgeport, who is involved in conflict mediation, conflict resolution, and I think some money needs to flow to these programs beyond a shadow of a doubt. Of
course. Well, let's remember, we only put $1.6 million in Safe Streets, and that was tough to get this year. And
that was a fight, wasn't it?
They almost didn't get it.
Yeah. That was a real fight.
Yeah.
The Mod Squad, Ted Graham and Stephen Janis of the Real News Network. Thank you, my friends, for your work, as
of
always.
We appreciate it.
We really appreciate it.
We'll see you next week.
Yep.
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Even before next week. A lot of stuff going on.
I know.
All right. Thank you all. Appreciate
Take care.
It. All right. Second hour of First Edition, the world famous happy hour. I see them setting up. They're here. The Elders, Paradox Family, Deep Sugar Family. The Elders are here. They're playing live. They're going to sit down for a chat first. But then they're going to do their thing. Looking forward to it. The World Famous is coming up. Stay tuned. You're listening to First Edition.